going to be every bit as bad as we've said, and worse. The closer we look, the worse it appears.
I'm John Krall. Coming up on No Limits, we're going to talk about the effect of health care reform on Indiana. The subject of health care reform has divided Americans and Hoosiers. Republicans in the U.S. House of Representatives have pledged to try to overturn it. And, as you just heard, Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels has been one of the most vocal critics of the reforms. Polls show that Americans and Hoosiers have strong opinions about health care, but don't know exactly what the reforms include. We'll talk about what the health care package is and isn't with experts in the field and you. Please join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881, emailing us at nolimits@wfyi.org, or sending questions or comments via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. But first, this news. Happy New Year and welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are talking today about the effects of federal health care reform on Indiana, and we're fortunate to have as our guest Dr. Tim Hobbs, who is the chief physician executive at Community Health Network. Tim, Dr. Hobbs, thank you for joining us today.
Hey, it's a pleasure.
Good to have you here. Also have Bob Paya, who is a benefits consultant with LHD Benefits. Bob, glad to have you with us.
Thank you, John.
Thank you for joining us. We're going to sort of frame this. Healthcare reform is a subject that people have really strong feelings about. As I think you will guess, Marianne Holland had an interview with Governor Mitch Daniels, who talked about healthcare reform. We'll listen to a little bit of that right now. Governor Mitch Daniels.
It's going to be every bit as bad as we've said, and worse. The closer we look, the worse it appears. We're going to prepare as though it's coming. I think that's the only smart thing to do. There's a chance of it being either found unconstitutional or somehow amended, but we can't plan on that. We've got a lot of big open questions. One, how do we handle a huge influx of people into Medicaid? How do you physically handle it, let alone the cost? We know the cost is going to be very, very high, but just how do you efficiently, fairly, accurately qualify people for that? The exchange, I'm thinking of appealing to the administration to liberalize the restrictions around these exchanges, because I just don't think this thing's going to work at all as it's set up. And maybe a number of states could band together and say, we'll run these exchanges if you'll grant us the following flexibilities and waivers. A major question we're looking at right now is its implications for our HIP program, and they seem pretty grim. Unless they change their mind down there, and they've given no evidence of that, HIP will be a thing of the past, and those folks will be in old-fashioned Medicaid.
I'm John Krall. You are listening to No Limits. That was Governor Mitch Daniels talking about the effects of federal health care reform on Indiana. And I should say here at the start of the show that we also had invited to be as one of our guests, Seema Verma, who is the health policy consultant and author of the Healthy Indiana Plan. And at present, she hasn't gotten to the studio. We don't know if there was a slip-up or a mix-up in communication, although we had gotten a confirmation. So there may be some questions we take up here that our two guests, learned as they are, may not be able to answer. I want to start this with a question of definitions, and I should say before I do that, I would invite our listeners to join this conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Again, that's 1-866-476-3881. You also can send emails at nolimits@wfyi.org or questions or comments via Facebook and Twitter at WFYI. People have really, really strong feelings about health care reform. All the polls indicate that. They indicate that it's really divided the country, divided the state. I think on balance, most of the polls indicate that Hoosiers oppose it and would like to see it overturned. Yet those same polls, when they check, indicate they really don't understand what it is or what it did, what the details are. So I'd like to start a little bit with talking about exactly what it is, then we can start talking about costs and benefits and figure out. So, Bob Pye, I'm guessing you spend a fair amount of your time these days actually explaining all of the changes in the healthcare business.
Yes.
So could you talk a little bit in overarching terms about what the healthcare reforms accomplished and what they didn't do?
Yeah, and that's true. Our firm works with Indianapolis or Indiana-based employers with their employee benefit programs. And as you can imagine, healthcare has been a big focus in trying to understand what this law is and how it impacts their benefit programs for their employees. So, yeah, we have spent a lot of time communicating what has happened with this legislation that's passed. Probably the biggest concern out there is with this legislation, it has expanded the access to healthcare in terms of people being able to obtain access for healthcare. But our big concern is in terms of the over underlying costs that really wasn't impacted very much with this legislation. We're not seeing any dramatic reductions in healthcare costs, unit costs going forward at this time. So that's one of the big issues.
Well, what are some of Dr. Tim Hobbs, what are some of the specific provisions of the healthcare reform that things, ways it changed the law before and the way that, and in some ways, is it fair to say people keep calling it healthcare reform? And in some ways it was more, it's not like they're changing the ways that you, as a doctor, as a physician, have right. to deliver care. It's about how we pay for it. So it's really in health insurance reform or some other health finance form or whatever reform.
That's correct, John, is that most of the attention has been paid to changing the health insurance or expanding coverage of insurance. And one of the I think targets was the uninsured individual and population that we have in our country, which is a very good and worthy cause to try to tackle that. Another thing that they did was try to protect individuals, provide some consumer protection by pre-existing conditions, for example, or allowing children of adults or parents to have their children on plans until age 26, those types of things. They also have expanded some Medicare preventive services, reducing copays or eliminating copays for prevention and services. So there was an intention to expand and improve. In addition to that, though, they also put a series of mandates which add costs, such as employers requiring individuals to purchase health insurance is another mandate. So when you look at this, that's a true statement. This is not really health care reform, and the real issues that as Bob is speaking to really get to the cost of health care, we're going to have to start to address how we deliver care, and which is the healthcare delivery design. And there is a connection, however, is the fact that typically healthcare delivery redesign follows how funding occurs in healthcare delivery systems. And so there is some connection, and in this plan you see some.
Could you give me – that's an interesting observation. How when you say that the financing affects the way it's delivered mm-hmm. – could you talk a little bit more about that? How it does that?
Let me go by starting with the market dynamics today and what they influence. Today, in most markets, when you talk about purchasing something, there's this concept called value, meaning that I'm willing to pay money for something. When I get it back, I really think I've got a good deal for what I get. Healthcare presently is not rewarded financially by providing value. Mm-hmm. Meaning I get better results, my well-being improves. Healthcare gets reimbursed by the more things you do, the better off you are. And in fact, mm-hmm. kind of in a cynical tone, we talk that the fact that actually the more inefficient we are, the worse we do, actually financially that's a more rewarding process. So what's happened in the federal health reform bill? They talk about these concepts called accountable care organizations, which this ACO has become a buzzword that, again, nobody knows what it means, but everybody has an opinion. The fundamental premise there is, how do we pay differently, and at the end of the day, the concept is, if we can keep our populations healthier, we can improve the efficiencies of how we deliver care, that the results of that improved health and the results of the increased efficiencies ought to go to those providing the care as a means of an incentive to produce the better results. And in that particular model, that would require us to retool and redesign how we deliver care in order to be able to accomplish those things, obviously. But then there would be the actual return on investment, so to speak, to be able to invest in the infrastructures, the IT systems, all those things that we believe are going to help us give better care. So without those economic changes in the marketplace, it is going to be nearly impossible in today's economic situation to make the types of changes that we need.
Bob Paya, you mentioned when we were talking that it really hasn't reduced costs for whom, basically?
Really for individuals and employer groups who provide health benefits to their employees. If anything, the legislation has expanded coverage in certain parameters, such as you mentioned, covering dependent adult children up to the age of 26. Prior to the legislation, the Indiana state law was up to age 24, so that did expand that beyond that. But even prior to the Indiana law, it was up to age 19, and then if you were typically a full-time college student, you could stay on the plan to a certain age limit beyond that. So now employers are sort of forced with having to cover adult children going forward. They are also required to change some of their benefits within their programs to expand coverage, such as a noble cause, but preventive care services have to be covered with no limitations, no cost sharing on the participant's behalf going forward. Certain limitations are going to be removed from plans, which are good for the consumer, but the issue is it does add to the underlying cost of the program. And typically what we see in the marketplace with the vendors we work with, they've shared with us that, looking at these new provisions they have to comply with that do phase in over the next few years. Just the 2010 provisions that kicked in for many employers January 1st, 2011, as they renewed their programs, was adding anywhere between, 1% to 4% to their health care costs on top of what their normal increase was going to be. So say they were looking at a 10% increase and they had to add on another, 2.5%, 3% for health care reform, that was, again, added on to their program.
And I know, Dr. Hobbs, you mentioned that employers are required to provide insurance. What is the force of the law there? What penalty is attached if you don't?
Well, they have for firms that have more than 50 employees, they're required, and they have penalties that they have to pay in terms of fines. One of the questions would be, because of the political process, that the level of that fine actually, when you look at your health care cost of providing health insurance, many firms believe that it would actually be less costly to take the fine than to provide the health insurance. So,
and that's been a source of some of the controversy here, is that
yes,
what the, in effect, I'm at, and this is something we're probably going to have to pick up on the other side of the break, but by and large, that there are employers who say they're going to pay the fine, and many of the opponents of the health care reform plan say that was sort of a backdoor then to a public option, which was what they opposed, and really, at least specifically, isn't in the plan. How large are these fines? Can you say that real quickly? Do you know, or is that?
I can address it. First off, the fines don't kick in until 2014. As I mentioned, many of the provisions kick in throughout the years, but 2014 is the real big year in this legislation. The individual mandate kicks in, where every U.S. citizen, man, woman, child, has to have health coverage, or every employer that's considered a larger employer has to offer coverage, and if they don't, they have to pay a fine. In general, the fine is $2,000 per full-time employee for companies with 50 or more full-time employees, but they can subtract the first 30 employees. So, yeah, you're exactly right, John. When you do the math, in most situations, pretty much every situation, an employer would actually save money by paying the fine, have their employees go to the exchange and get their own coverage and really, you know, get that off their plate, that they don't have to deal with it anymore. And that's one of the big concerns, and that, you know, our constituents and the health plan vendors came out, because when the fines were announced, it was much smaller than I think what was anticipated.
You are listening to No Limits. We're talking with Dr. Tim Hobbs and Bob Paya about health care reform and its effects here in Indiana. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Krall, Director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We're talking about the effects of federal health care reform on Indiana. And our guests are Dr. Tim Hobbs, Chief Physician Executive at Community Health Network, and Bob Paya, Benefits Consultant with LHD Benefits. We're talking really about the costs of the health care package so far. And I think right now I'm trying to keep, because this is very confusing, right, and it was a huge, huge undertaking. That is there agreement among the two of you that there's a benefit in the fact that a whole lot of people who weren't insured before, and or if they, you know, in some sense you could say in this country they were insured, it was just a very inefficiently delivered system, in that they'd show up in an emergency room when something was really horrible and expensive to treat, and we'd have to provide the care then, or Dr. Hobbs, you would have to provide the care then. But now the costs are, we're looking at a greater burden on businesses to provide health insurance, and probably, you know, some confusion about exactly what the new benefits are. Is that a fair assessment, Dr. Hobbs?
Yes, yes, I believe so. And, you know, maybe to put the, if I may put this in a little bit of perspective.
Sure, please.
We're talking about cost. The reason that healthcare reform or insurance reform, whatever we want to call this, is occurring is because we have a huge cost issue.
Mm-hmm.
And so really what we're speaking of here is something's going to cost us here, mm-hmm, one way or the other. Kind of in my mind's eye, it's sort of like we've been in this raft going down this stream and it's nice and quiet. Well, now we're in the currents are starting to pick up. Well, what a lot of us don't see is that mist is not a nice cloud. That's a big waterfall we're getting ready to fall over. And the natural economic currents are not going to create a healthcare system that any of us like or will work well for us. So there's already cost for today of the increasing premiums and the cost of healthcare that's eroding into working class, middle class folks' incomes and standards of living. And that's creeping up.
And has been for quite a while.
Has quite a while and continues to do so, not to mention the impact on our whole federal government. So when we look at healthcare reform,
And can I take a step back real quickly here and just ask, what's produced that incremental creep? I mean, as a layman, my assumption would be, at some level, it's the fact that A, we're living longer.
Go
ahead.
You know, we have expanding. In fact, if you look at the 70% of our healthcare costs today are created by five chronic health conditions that people carry. You look at the individuals 65 years of age and older, they have on average five individual conditions at the same time, requiring them to see somewhere in the neighborhood of 12 to 14 different physicians, 50 prescriptions per year. And so basically you can see which is a huge burden on our cost system. Technologies continue to advance. As you mentioned, we keep living longer, which guarantees we're going to have more chronic conditions. And quite frankly, our payment system and our healthcare system as it exists today is not equipped to handle and manage that type of burden as we move forward.
We're talking about the effects of federal healthcare reform on Indiana, and I'd like to invite our listeners to join this conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Or you can send an email at nolimits, that's one word, at WFYI.org, or comments or questions via Facebook and Twitter at WFYI. We've talked about how things phase in and that really we're not going to see all of the pieces of this come together till the year 2014. Bob Pye of LHD Benefits, could you talk a little bit about exactly what the timetable is here, that what comes online when, what the costs and the benefits of each step might be?
Sure. To step back a little bit, this legislation that we refer to as healthcare reform was the name of the legislation was the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, and it was actually passed back in March of 2010, and the implementation date was 6 months forward. So really, after September 23rd, 2010, any policies, any new policies or any renewing policies had to start complying with these provisions. Now, many of these provisions, I said earlier, they do phase in over the years. In 2010, you mentioned some of the provisions in terms of adult children over the age of 26, up to the age of 26, can now be covered through their parents' plan, regardless of their status. Remove some lifetime limits, remove the pre-existing condition clause for children, enhance preventive benefits, things of that nature. 2011, other provisions kicked in. To name one that's probably on top of everybody's mind today is changes to pre-tax plans, such as a flexible spending account and a health savings account, where in the past individuals could use their monies to buy over-the-counter medications at the local pharmacy or merchant. Those went away January 1st, so people no longer use those funds for those pre-tax purchases. And also other reporting requirements kick in as well. But, yeah, in the big year with this legislation is really 2014. 2014, when it comes about, as you heard Mitch, our Governor Mitch Daniels mention, every state has to have their health exchange up and running for individuals and employers to go to. On the employer side, it's really intended for the small employer to begin with. Beyond that, if you don't participate, there'll be individual fines levied on the individual or on employers above 50 lives they don't participate through the program. And again, the concern there is that the fines are, in our opinion, not substantial enough to really motivate people to, offer coverage. So we anticipate in many respects, for example, many small employer groups, will come 2014 just pretty much drop their group health plans, tell their employees go to the exchange, and get their coverage.
We've talked, and I think Dr. Hobbs was talking about the moment that kind of led us to this package. I probably should have started this by asking a pretty basic question. Was the system we had in need of reform? Bob Pye.
In general, there's always need for reform and things can be fine-tuned. But in general, the system we had today through an employer-based system with also some government-run programs and individuals' ability to go get coverage, worked well. People had the choice. And I think one of the outcries or concerns for the general public was now, very soon they're not going to have a choice anymore. That's being taken away from them. And obviously we're seeing that in some of these state lawsuits that are being filed, and Indiana is actually participating in that, saying that this is unconstitutional, saying that to mandate individuals that they have to go out and buy an insurance consumer product is unheard of. So I think that's part of the outcry too, is consumers out there concerned about being forced to have to go out and purchase health coverage that they may not want.
Okay. Dr. Hobbs, did you think the system was in need of reform? What, we can talk about whether this was the reform that was needed,
right,
which is the second part of that question. But
that's where I probably have a different take than Bob on that. And when it comes to delivery of health care and some of the issues driving our cost, absolutely we needed a reform in our health care system. Whether the insurance provision reform, that's another issue. But how we deliver care absolutely needs to be reformed. And I think the payment systems need to be reformed in order to be able to get a better result for our patient population and our patients, and also for our standard of living. So I would say yes.
We're going to take a caller right now. Steve, you're calling from Indianapolis. How are you doing? Welcome to the program.
Thank you. How are you guys doing?
Doing very, very well. What's your question?
Okay, well, it's more of a point.
Okay.
When I was 22, I was forced to file bankruptcy after racking up $80,000 in medical debt because the insurance company that I had been paying faithfully would not cover me because it was a pre-existing condition.
Well, and why don't that I think gets to sort of the point of why we were brought to health care reform. Do you mind if I reframe that a little bit as a question real quickly?
Sure.
And that is, you know, if these reforms were not possibly, and I think, Bob Pye, you have some doubts about whether this reform was effective. Was there a way then, another way that effectively could deal with that problem of pre-existing conditions? And, Steve, I'll thank you for the call.
Sure.
Take care. Bob Pye. Is there another way? Is there a way we could have dealt with the pre-existing condition thing other than what's mandated in these health care reforms? Do you think there were other ways that we could have solved the pre-existing condition problem?
Well, I mean, I think mentioned John at the beginning of the program that this is a very complex issue, and the issues that we're dealing with cannot be solved by single solutions.
Mm-hmm.
And so as because of the complexity of the situation we're in, for example, in this pre-existing condition, so we pick a solution which shifts a burden to some other individual or some other entity. And so at this case, I would say the way we're set up, for sure that I did not see another way that we could have dealt with that. Having said that, though, then that burden gets shifted to employers, gets shifted to insurance companies. That in itself is not a solution. And that's where, if I might just go on just a bit, is that healthcare reform is that it's going to be an exceedingly complex process, multiple. And the plan that we have before us today is little understood because it's a collection of mandates, different public insurance expansions, subsidies, regulations. And unlike Medicare or Social Security that had specific program, had a goal in mind, this one is reform, and you can use healthcare reform to say a lot of different things and mean a lot of different things.
Oh yeah, I think we probably could agree that taking it as a civic education question, that putting a lot of things in one package and then expecting people to digest and understand it all is almost impossible. We're getting a lot of calls, so I'm going to take another one real quickly. Bob, you're calling from Carmel. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. I understand you've got a specific question about basically administrative costs.
Yeah, it's my understanding that in the United States we pay about 30% of our health care bill in administrative costs. And in other countries in socialized medicine, they pay about 5% because they have one computer system and one form no matter where you are in the whole country. And we have multiple kinds of things, multiple insurance companies and all that stuff. Did this bill address that at all, do I have my facts straight?
Okay, well, we'll take that. Thank you. That's a good question. Thanks for joining the program. Bob Pye, are his facts straight, and does the bill address the problem?
Well, the exact percentages I really couldn't comment on, but yeah, I would say in general our administrative costs here in the United States are slightly higher than other nations, just due to the fact that obviously we have multiple health plans out in the marketplace, and where other countries have a single payer system or a more streamlined system, which would provide them a lower admin cost arrangement. But I 30% in terms of overall admin sounds too high to me. I would say the typical figure I hear on the is more in the 15 to 12% range is more in the range I hear.
Dr. Hobbs, does this bill address those administrative costs in any way or bring them under control?
I believe there's an attempt to, and there's a debate on the insurance companies need to pay a certain percentage of what they collect in premiums out in certain for healthcare benefits and cost. And so right now I know there's a debate on what do you count on which side of the ledger. Can you count care managers or certain advertising or certain outreach programs as an administrative expense, or is that actually a provision of care? So there is an attempt in this bill to begin addressing that, and that's about as far as my knowledge will take me on that. But I know that's in there.
Bob Pyatt, do you have more you could add there?
Yeah, I could. Part of the law did establish what they call minimum medical loss ratios upon health insurance plans. And in general, it does set parameters in terms of how much health plans, health insurance companies need to spend on care for cost of care. And in general, for individuals and a small employer group plan, health insurance carriers are required to spend 80% on actual cost of care, where a larger employer, it's at 85%. So that leaves, obviously, the carrier for a larger employer at 15% to cover their costs. And obviously, many are in the business to make a profit, too. And on the small employer, at least about 20%.
You Dr. Might, Hobbs, yeah.
You know, there's alluding to the rest of the world, and we are the only nation in the world that has an employer-based health health delivery system or insurance system. All the others are basically government-run or some other. In fact, and that occurred in our country back in the 1940s as a kind of an IRS as at the end of the war, and to help attract more workers. And so there was it was sort of wasn't a planned process, but it was sort of the system we have happened as much as it was planned.
It sounds sort of like traffic planning in Houston, you know, at those places where things sort of grow organically, and then you look at something and wonder how the heck it evolved. Let me just say real quickly, suppose for a moment we were, and we have other callers, and I'm going to get to them, but I don't want to put someone on the air just to go to a break, so I'm going to ask this question real quickly. Real quickly, in a very bullet point form, if we made you kind of czar just to deal with improving the way that we pay for health care in this country, what would you do? I'll start with Bob Paya on that one, of LHD Benefits.
Well, one thing we could do is obviously pay for results. As Dr. Hobbs mentioned, our current system is more of a fee-for-service type system, so the more tests the provider runs, the more services they run, the more, obviously, revenue they make. So one thing we can do is try to change that structure to be more of a quality focus in terms of what's the best test to run, what's the best course of treatment for this condition, and follow those results, because that would reduce the number of unnecessary tests or services provided. So that's definitely a part of this legislation, which I think down the road will help. Going forward, if we do actually change the fee structure. Now, there will be a lot of resistance to that out there, I believe, just because there will be resistance to that form.
Yeah, your insurance costs go up if your doctor tells you need to lose weight and you don't do it, or some such. Dr. Hobbs, what would you do?
I agree with Bob along those lines. I think some of the provisions and some of the work that's been performed in these, and I mentioned these accountable care organizations, and where there's a mutual accountability between all stakeholders, patients, employers, providers, and they all have the same skin in the game, and then providing the right data and information to make those to make their correct decisions.
We're having a lively conversation about the effects of federal health care reform on Indiana. We're talking with Dr. Tim Hobbs, Chief Physician Executive at Community Health Network, and Bob Paya, who's the Benefits Consultant with LHD Benefits. And we are going to be talking with a lot of our listeners who are lined up as soon as we take this short break. Please stay with us. You are listening to No Limits, and it's good to have you here. I'm John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We're talking about the effects of federal health care reform on Indiana. I've had a pretty lively conversation so far, and I think we're going to continue to have one. I'm going to ask Dan from Franklin, Indiana, a place where I teach, to join the conversation. Dan, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Thank you for joining the program. Understand you've got a question about COBRA.
Yeah. Our situation is that I previously was employed in a large organization and then went out to be an entrepreneur, and we started a small business that is doing okay, believe it or not, in this economy. But we ended the 18 months of COBRA eligibility last October. And, of course, none of this health care reform did anything to address the, even though there were massive subsidies for paying for COBRA for a few months, they didn't do anything to extend that when that 19th month comes. And as our family is in a kludgy mess where I'm getting VA, if I get in trouble, my wife has gotten a part-time job to get health insurance for her, and my kids are applying for Hoosier HealthWise, which is a mess. But it's a classic example of being sort of forced into the public option when we didn't want it. We were willing, although it was difficult, to pay the higher COBRA premium. The insurance company was happy to insure us when we pay that premium, but this arbitrary 18th month ended it. And even if we get to the point, as we hope to have a few employees in our business, I've basically been told by the insurance brokers that until we have at least three different families that are working full-time, nobody will write us a small business policy, so we won't even be able to provide health care for our employees, though we would like to. It seems like if small businesses are the engines of job creation and we've got this other economic crisis, they would have paid attention to the impacts on people who want to be entrepreneurs or who are entrepreneurs instead of trying to wholesale take over the whole process at the opposite end of the spectrum. I just would be interested in, if I'm crazy or if your guests could comment on that issue.
Well, I won't ask him for a diagnosis. So, but I do appreciate it, and I think it's a very good question. Bob Paya, could you, and Dan, thank you for joining the program. Thank you for bringing us such a good question.
Yeah, Dan is right. The COBRA subsidies have expired, so he probably did see an increase in his COBRA premiums because of that subsidy expiration. But the small group employer market here in Indiana, as long as you have two employees, two full-time eligible employees, you can go out and get a group plan. And players who are participating in that small group market is a guaranteed issue market. So
what does that mean?
A guaranteed issue means they no matter what your underlying disclosed health conditions are on the insurance application, they have to make an offer to you. So if a carrier is filed in the state of Indiana with the Department of Insurance doing business in that small group marketplace, which is defined as two employees up to 50 eligible employees, they have to make you an offer. Now, they do have obviously rating limits in terms of what their minimum rate can be and maximum rate can be based on what's disclosed on the applications. But he could go out today and get a small group plan, assuming he's got two full-time employees with his company.
Yes, and we're gonna take another call. Tom, I'm sorry, you're calling from Indianapolis?
Yes, I am.
And what is your question? Thanks for joining the program.
Well, I think this is relevant, but may not be in the context of what you're speaking, but we're talking about care costs, and Indiana is not doing too well in the health care business, I guess, in general, as far as our general population is concerned. But I was thinking, there's no program, I know it's a federal program, but is there any program within there as a preventive medicine? Because I think most of our health care costs is a result of our own irresponsibilities to our health itself. Therefore, as you were talking about all the diseases, the five major ones, after 65, probably a lot of those result because people didn't take care of themselves. So I don't know why the government doesn't move towards more preventive as opposed to raising health care costs for take care of the after effects. So.
Good question. I think that actually dealt with this, what we were talking to some degree about right before the break when we were talking about the focus.
Yeah.
Both of you want to get in on that one. Tom, thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
Bob Paya or Tom
Hobbs,
whichever.
I'd be happy to tackle it. The health care reform legislation, that was one of the provisions that did kick in, which was unlimited preventive coverage with no cost for the participant. So if you have a health plan today that's in compliance with the legislation, that they have to provide preventive care at no cost to the participant on either an individual or a group-based model.
Okay. And Tim Hobbs, Dr. Hobbs.
Well, and there's also some provisions to provide subsidies to certain employers that offers wellness mm-hmm. programs, for example. There are also provisions to start disclosing the actual ingredients and nutritional value of certain school-based foods and those types of things. So as far as prevention, there is a fairly actually a fairly heavy dose of prevention baked in different places within this reform plan.
Okay. We've gotten an email question, and to do it justice, I think I'm just going to have to read it verbatim. It says, as far as the overall health care law, There seem to be many needed reforms in it. However, my concern stems from a current practice I've come across in dealing with their insurance companies, that of being charged more, perhaps several hundred dollars per year, for those like me who have no credit rating or a poor one, even though I currently have a job and no debt. Will the required health insurance of the new law allow insurance companies to charge more to those with no or low credit ratings? I consider this a form of discrimination. The second question I have is whether we're creating another too-big-to-fail industry in the form of the insurance medical complex. Why don't we deal with the first question first, the closer to the ground. Will the required health insurance of the new law allow insurance companies to charge more to those with no or low credit ratings?
No, there's no parameters in the legislation that if your credit rating scores below a certain level, your premium is going to be higher or surcharged. No, there's nothing in there in that regard.
And then let's take the more global question here, the Eisenhower question, I guess, here. He was the guy who warned about the military-industrial complex, the insurance-medical complex.
Well,
here.
I mean, if you look at health care, I think we're already past that point. Health care, in fact, just today it was reported, is now 17.6% of our gross domestic product. That's larger than almost every civilized nations and GDP, other than about three other countries, I believe. So, so we already have an issue. And then when you look at from the point of view that we are in debt for our Medicare's and our Social Security, you'll have to throw that in there to a tune somewhere in the neighborhood. If we had to pay back that debt, about $150,000 per citizen of our country, I would say we're already in a situation in my view, again, some form of health. We've got to reform our health system because we are in a situation that I believe will have an impact on our standard of living if we do not.
Bob Paya, do you think we're creating another too-big-to-fail industry here?
Well, I think the concern is, I guess what first thought comes to my mind is with these health exchanges because of the complexity of the exchanges and the administration and the cost behind them in terms of every state trying to run these exchanges, which are going to be very difficult, to say the least, in terms of looking at the eligibility, who's eligible for vouchers, subsidies, tax credits. It's going to be a complicated issue, and obviously the states have a big challenge ahead of them with these exchanges, and obviously time will tell, but it could be an undertaking that may just be too difficult.
We got a question, too, came in that said, has anybody in this process questioned the profits of insurance companies or pharmaceuticals or anything like that? I mean, is there an argument to be made in something that is essential, you know, to some degree, we're asking a question whether it should be for profit or we should consider at some level health care a utility, and the profits of those companies be monitored because it's essential to life. Dr. Hobbs, I suspect your thoughts there because you've got competing. You at some level you have to run a business. On the other hand, you're bound by some oaths as a physician too.
Exactly, and I believe that the concept of making even in our not-for-profits, which I'm a part of, we need profit, I guess, but the difference is we take that profit and invest back into the care delivery system and to keep providing better care.
Yeah, if you keep losing not-for-profit doesn't mean for loss.
Exactly. I think that issue of profit. Now the other question is healthcare, and this is a societal question. Is healthcare a right, or is it a business and of all of our citizens? And I think that's one that I believe whichever side you land on, I think we can all agree that a healthy society is a better off society, a higher standard of living. So I think it behooves all of us to have a very healthy healthcare system. I think at the end of the day, if everyone can have access to health care, we have a better system of how we reimburse in order to bring some of the cost, unnecessary cost, under control. that those two things together then offer us the best, you know, the kind of the best solution for whichever side of that argument you land on.
Should there be, and Bob Pye, this one hits, I guess, fairly close to the heart of what you do. Should there be caps on profits for insurance companies or pharmaceuticals?
It sort of gets to the heart of the free enterprise system we have here in our country.
No, I know. I'm touching the third rail here.
Yeah, exactly.
I grabbed it with both hands. So.
There shouldn't be a cap or a limit on that. But even in today's environment, you know, before all this legislation has passed, you know, if you break down, look at the industries, obviously the health insurance companies are the ones who are most pointed out in terms of being, if you will, the bad industry, but yet they have the smallest profit margins as a group entirely. And that's the industry where we've seen massive consolidation in terms of the number of companies that are out there participating in that business because it is so difficult. So in general, I'd say no, we live in a free market, free enterprise. There's a lot of reasons why we have the system we have in our country. It has shown to provide value and provide motivation for people to provide a good or service that people want.
Dr. Hobbs, yeah.
Just to add on to that, I mean, I agree with Bob that the free enterprise system, I believe, is still the best system. But I think the element there is, are we really providing the value? And are each of these elements providing value, or are they finding ways to make profits that don't necessarily add value? And I think that we can find examples, and I'll include providers into this as well, providers, whether it be pharmaceuticals or whether they be insurance companies that don't always add value as a means of making their profit. So that would be the caveat and from my point of view.
Well, and we've gotten an email question from Don in Greenwood, who says, really, is the free market system the best way to deliver health care, or would some other approach work better? I mean, at some level, Bob Pye, you framed your answer by saying we live in a free market system,
yeah.
But is that the best possible way to do this?
Yeah, I believe the free market system is the best way to do this. It provides more ideas to come forward compared to more of a socialized program, I believe. I mean, obviously, we can compare the free market system versus Medicare and Medicaid. Obviously, Medicare and Medicaid, as we all know, now as part of this reform too, is you know, not too far in the horizon. They were going to become insolvent, wouldn't be a viable program anymore. So that was another motivation to try to pass this legislation to extend the life of those programs down the road, given our baby boomer population that's coming. But I believe the free enterprise system does provide the marketplace for people to come to the market with new ideas, new concepts, new approaches, and the ones with the best ideas, you know, will win, just like in any other industry that's out there.
Dr. Hobbs, free market system the best way to deliver health care, or are there other systems that would do it better?
My belief is the free market system is the best system with the, and I've already expressed my views on the caveats of that of that issue. So,
well, let me ask another question. I think picking up on comments both of you have made here that would deal with the other side of that question is part of the problem in your view that, you know, we're applying free market principles to the businesses that are doing this, you know, by and large, the insurances, but not to the consumers. You talked about preventative and outcome and all of that. Do we need to create a better system of incentives for healthcare consumers so that if they hit certain targets, for example, if I go see Dr. Hobbs and he tells me I need to drop 30 pounds and stop smoking, and I do it, I see those costs more immediately. Bob Pye, you're nodding your head up and down. Is it that we haven't done the applied the free market principles on both sides of the equation?
Yeah. Well, I think you touch upon the other side of this coin, which is individual responsibility. You know, as we all are responsible for our own individual health and well-being, and a lot of studies out there have shown that, you know, an individual's overall health status is very attributable to the way they take care of themselves. And part of that is right. Yeah, going in and getting a preventive care visit from your physician once a year to get sort of a checkup, make sure how you're doing. But a big part of overall healthcare costs and reform is individual responsibility in terms of taking care of yourself, you know, eating properly, exercise, all those type of things. Because if you ultimately don't take care of those items for yourself personally, obviously it's going to lead to consequences down the road.
Well, and I guess where I'm getting at with this too, Dr. Hobbs, is it, should we build in a system, a more complete system of financial incentives for people to take care of themselves?
I mean, absolutely. I think every stakeholder, and if the premise of is the fact is the healthier population costs us less, and you look at what are the drivers of the health of a population, 40% of those drivers are related to health behaviors of individuals, and only 10% or so related to what we do in our exam rooms with patients and in our acute care. 15% are socioeconomic, and the other 30% have to do with genetics. So, yeah, if you don't address those issues, we will also have a very difficult time.
I would like to thank all of our listeners and the folks who called in, made this program such a lively one, and I hope generated some greater understanding of what is a complex topic. We've been talking about the effects of federal health care reform here in Indiana. I'd like to express my thanks also to my guest, Dr. Tim Hobbs, Chief Physician Executive at Community Health Network. Dr. Hobbs, thank you for joining us today. I hope you'll come back sometime.
Hey, it was a real pleasure, John. Appreciate it.
Thank you. And Bob Paya, who is Benefits Consultant with LHD Benefits. Bob, thank you. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you, John.
We are going to be back next week where we're going to have a show that deals with livability, what it's going to take to make Indianapolis a super city as we head toward the Super Bowl a little more than a year from now. And our guests are going to be some of the people who've made that happen. Again, Happy New Year, and we will look forward to talking with you next Thursday. I'm John Kroll. Thanks for joining us.
No Limits is a production of WFYI Radio, 90.1 FM and HD1. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Cedric Freeman. Board Engineers, Matt Sosi and Josh Hamig. And Intern, Savannah Rains. We invite you to join us each Thursday at noon for No Limits, and you can listen online at WFYI.org.